The minute you start putting jazz in a box and it becomes dusty like museum music, why bother? And those musicians who kind of, you want to preserve, quality, excellence, all that type of thing, but you want to continue walking down the road.
Welcome to episode 116 of the Bass Shed Podcast. My name is Ryan Roberts. All right, what's up, folks? What's up, folks? Welcome to the Bass Shed Podcast. How y'all doing? Hopefully your gig schedules are a little bit busier than mine. January is typically a pretty slow month on the gig front. But I kind of don't mind it. Like, I could use the break a little bit and I, use some time to invest into some other things. As I talked about on the last episode, NAMM 2024 is happening this week. I decided not to attend the Southern California Band and Orchestra Association conference, although that seems and sounds like an amazing party. Yes, I'm not going to that so I can spend a couple more days at NAMM. I think I'll be there at the NAMM show Friday and Saturday. I have a few meetings scheduled, and I'm interested to putz around and see what's there this year. I don't expect to really be blown away by anything. I think I can't imagine anything radical has changed in the music industry or in the bass world, lately. But I'm always excited to check out the different booths. All right, this is also happening. The Bass Shed is going through a little bit of a reconfiguration. I don't know. All that. A little bit of a process at the moment, just kind of revamping things. The Bass Shed Academy website will be hosting all the lessons and transcriptions, and I will be shooting out an email to all the members of thebassshed.com about that shift in things, about where a lot of that media is going to be. I have a new studio space that I'm working out of, and some new members of the team. Christopher Damon is a great bass player. In the Chicago area, he is back to helping me out with the podcast production. And also Mr. Daniel Dubsworth, owner of the record label Dubs Alive and an electric bassist in the SoCal area, recently joined the team. I met Daniel when he attended the second masterclass with Jerry Germont. I'm excited to have Daniel on board. Check out his label at dubsalive.com. Daniel and I were hanging last week. He was hipping me to some new bands that I hadn't checked out, some music history things I didn't know about. He's got a very different approach to the bass world than I do, and I loved learning from him and checking out a bunch of the music he sent me. So big shout out to Daniel and Christopher. You both are killing, and I'm honored to have you on board. All right, and here's my regularly scheduled shout out to Lemur Music, lemurmusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass. Stop by the website and shop their inventory of bows, pickups, sheet music, and accessories. Use the promo code TheBassShed, all one word, for 10% off. Lemurmusic.com. Everything you need for the double bass. On the episode is bassist David Rodriguez. David has worked with groups ranging from Isaac Hayes to Tito Puente, to the Rochester Philharmonic. He studied at Juilliard, the Eastman School of Music, and Mansfield University. David is currently the executive producer and executive vice president of the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, where the Milt Hinton Institute for Studio Bass is held.
Hey, Ryan.
Hey man, you there?
I am here.
Cool, how you doing?
And hanging in, how about you?
Nice, nice. Sorry about the little delay.
No, it happens. I've been
moving into this space. I've been moving things around at the house. It's been a gnarly two weeks.
Understand. I have Chevy Chase showing up at 4, so I'll have to leave.
What's that about? Tell me about that.
We're doing a screening of Christmas Vacation.
Oh,
and he's going to talk after it. So
nice. So you're playing along with the film?
No, it's just a straight through. It's just an entertainment thing. Just producing.
Oh, that's cool.
Producing more these days than anything else. So
okay. What other kind of things do you produce?
I do about 600 events a year. So
wow.
I build, programs in Madison Square Garden and Radio City Music Hall to, we have a big North to Shore festival, and I'm the artistic director for a venue called the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, where we're doing the programs. So,
cool, man. Sounds like you're a busy guy.
Aren't we all? It's the holiday.
Yes.
I mean, the producing thing was how I got involved with Max Roach for the most part. I played with him a little bit when I was younger, kind of in my teenage years.
Yeah.
And, then led to some work with Tito Puente. But at the end of the day, I think bass players make the best producers, because your job essentially is to try and make other people sound good.
Yes.
You also understand, the crazy that happens on both sides. So my feeling was, if I could be that bridge between, these musicians who, I love so much, and the business side of it, it made a lot of sense. So, it led to me doing a lot of that type of stuff.
Cool. Let's dig into kind of your musical background. So you played with Max, you played with Tito. Mm-hmm. What's kind of your story? How did you get introduced with the bass? Like, what were you, what was your educational network kind of coming up?
I started out at, playing acoustic guitar. There was a guy on the corner who taught chess and acoustic guitar. I'll try acoustic guitar.
What city is this? Where are we at in the country? In New York. Okay.
Newark, New Jersey.
Newark. Yeah. Okay.
And they, and at a certain point, someone said, you'll get a lot more gigs if you played bass. And I always felt the bass a whole lot more. So, that led me going to upright, and I started, went to Juilliard on the weekends, took the subway over there, and then, got to playing around. Played, down the Jersey Shore with some rock groups, played with a lot of jazz things and jams and whatever, and ended up, and at the end of the day, started going on tours. And then, as I said, I wanted to kind of find that middle point. I was sick of smelling the diesel fume of buses. Yeah. And I also at the time was playing nights at the Vanguard on Monday nights, which is a really cool gig, but it only pays $25. So, and like, as the day goes on, more musicians come in from, who are playing in the pits and Broadway and all that type of thing. And if you have charts, you can have them play. And, and there were, Mel Lewis was playing drums, so it was really cool. But if you got a country Western gig that paid $700, suddenly, you're subbing out, and you get point that you're kind of, whoring out your passion. So I figured if I had another role in there that, that I didn't have to, as they say, fame don't pay the rent. That's
right.
If I can play with the people I want to play by not having to worry about the bread, could, kind of balance both things. So it got to the point that if Max had a gig that, hardly paid anything, it's like, I don't care. I just want to play,
Yeah.
And that was a lot more sane. So I still have my passion.
I think that's
around, but
I think that's a necessary kind of occupational lesson for the kids coming up. Is like, I mean, I have things I do that are all music related and bass related to, so I don't have to take every gig ever all the time. And I like what you were talking about, I could just choose to take the gigs I want to take.
I still end up sometimes with people who are, they call me up for gigs, and I feel like just, out of action. No, I have to take it because if not, someone else
can
take
it. I know, but you should become so conditioned to not even understanding how to say no to anything. Like, yeah, I can do it. Get me on it. What's it pay? I pay you $200. Cool. Get me on it.
There you go. Because if not, they won't call again. It's like, well, maybe I don't want them to call.
Isn't that it, man? It becomes such your mind gets conditioned so easy into this survivalist mentality.
It's like Pavlovian gigging.
Right. It's, yeah. So who were you playing with at the Vanguard on Mondays? I mean, I thought Mel and Thad, that big band, was the ongoing gig forever.
It was an ongoing gig for Mondays, but it never paid a whole lot. And so you had, all kinds of, Slide Hampton would be playing trombone and, all kinds of different things. I remember one time I got called for another gig and it was an all-female big band called the Kit McClure Big Band out in, it was for some black tie event. And it paid well. So I wasn't there that night and, played bass and in this all-female big band. And I looked down, I looked to my right, and I was like, and Mel was playing drums. And I'm thinking, I understand me, but not you.
Yeah. Right.
Like a gig's a gig, man.
Yeah. Yeah, that's it. That's right, it.
But I'm still playing around. I'm doing a tour with a guitarist named Gil Gutierrez. And we'll be playing a week at Birdland coming up. I'm going to be doing some tour dates down in Mexico, and we're going to Havana and Medellin and Colombia. Okay. So playing, actually, it's just, a trio with acoustic guitar, upright bass, and violin.
Oh, nice.
Because he used to be with Paco de Lucia way back and played with a lot
of
other folks. So it's just a cool gig. There's more space. There's different responsibilities musically and all that type of thing. So, it's that balance.
What's the nature of that music? Is that kind of a flamenco, South American
It's kind of
thing?
Yeah, like flamenco meets jazz, meets, classical.
Tango, maybe?
There's Piazzolla in there. There's some, which is really interesting because I played on Piazzolla's last album. Astor was, so whenever I play it, he used to say before you play, he goes, whenever you're playing tango, you either play like you're going to make love or like you're going to kill somebody.
Yeah.
and he goes, in Argentina, if we're going to kill somebody, we kill them with a knife. It's more personal. So, so I always feel like I have to get in my mindset when I play tango and that kind of thing.
Let's talk about the Institute for the Bass. So you're producing this bass camp, the Milt Hinton Institute for the Bass Studio.
Yep.
Talk a little bit about that. How did you start the program, or are you just kind of a director of the program?
No. What's
your involvement?
Well, NJPAC, New Jersey Performing Arts Center, is going to be the home of it. Mm-hmm. It's a new home of it, There's a number of wonderful bassists who are part of it, including one of my favorites in the world, and Rufus Reed. I used to go to a little club and watch him play duets after every gig I did down in the village. And there's nobody in terms of
playing bass duets. Was it that thing?
Yeah, when he played like with Kurt Leitzig and all those folks down at Bradley's in the village.
Okay,
way back when in. The late 70s, early 80s. And, occasionally you could sit in and it was one of those things where, you just had to know the tune and they'd try to mess you up. It was that and that was, probably one of the earliest times I saw Christian McBride, because he was going up there and he's now our jazz advisor here. So he's doing this with the bass camp as well. And the thought is, I guess most recently it was at the University of Wisconsin, and it's funded through Milt Hinton's estate. And and the thought is to give that space for bassists, and applications will open soon. And it'll probably be 30 to 40 bass players. We'll spend a couple of weeks working with the best people in the world, what I think.
Sure.
And not just dealing with their playing, but dealing with the nuts and bolts of living as a musician, you know, what do you do for an attorney? What do you do with gigs? What do you do with all those various things? And it's, you know, I believe it's something like 15, you know, ages 15 to the early 20s. So it's at a key time when people are making decisions. And particularly
right, kind of like the beginning of high school, late middle school into college,
early college
age,
that kind of thing. It's sometimes you just need that haven. And by the same
time,
having people,
yeah,
you know, so all the bass luthiers that are around that, you know, can mm-hmm. talk to you about the health of your bass and all that type of thing.
Right. David Gage coming out there making an appearance.
I talked to Gage about it as well. Sam Finley as well. So,
okay.
Sam's around. He just opened up Finley Gage just opened up just a couple miles away from the venue. So they're in New York and New Jersey now. So
sweet.
I just got the bass behind me from him.
Yeah, I see that. What is it? What's the bass?
It is a Sam Morel, who's been with him for
okay.
a while from France, and he made it. It just went to ISB and got some kind of an award. But more than anything, it just it's kind of our bass that we use here. I've, as a bassist, I don't want people to come in and you know, have crummy bassists. Bassists aren't touring with their instruments anymore,
mm-hmm.
so I don't understand that at all. But, you know, we just had Abdul Ibrahim.
Cost.
We just said, yeah, I mean, it's, yeah. But just showing up with the, where you might have an instrument that has, you know, action that's an inch and a half high, you know,
yeah.
What do you do? So
right,
I'm just not letting that happen. So
yeah, good for
that,
you.
That bass gets more gigs than I do.
Yeah, I used to make that joke. Ben Williams came out to L.A., and rented my bass off me and cut like the Chris Daddy Dave record. I think he did a Christian Scott record. Like my bass was on, you know, my bass was on way more records than I was that year.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's hilarious.
We'll be back right after this.
All right, folks, get heard on the Bass Shed podcast. I am opening up the middle of the show to talk about what you all are up to. Stop by thebassshed.com, click on Get Featured, and let me know what news you'd like me to share. If it's upcoming gigs, if it's your website, if it's your social media handles, if it is your YouTube page, whatever it is, stop by thebassshed.com, click on Get Featured, and exactly that, Get Featured on the Bass Shed podcast. All right, so the middle of the show is to feature listeners, right? I want to hear from listeners. I want to hear what you're up to. All that stuff. You can find more information about that at thebassshed.com/feature. I do want to talk about this. I do not make a habit of reading through the comments about the podcast. I did. And I came across this one. The caption, or excuse me, the review of the podcast is titled, "Ask the question and shut up!" Exclamation point. The screen name for this person is B flat jazz bass. Here's the comment. Here's the review. Here's the comment review as it was written. Here it is. "Dude, you got some cool cats on the podcast and we want to hear what they have to say. There's nothing worse than the host asking a question, then the guest starts to answer and the host interrupts. Just shut the F up and let's hear what the guest has to say. Period. Got it. Exclamation point. That's the review in its entirety. All right, B flat jazz bass. Why don't you shoot me an email, man? Ryan@thebassshed.com. This was a very personal review, and so let's get personal. Hit me up. I definitely have some questions for you. Ryan@thebassshed.com. So B flat jazz bass, if you're listening, contact me, man. I'm assuming it's male, right? That has a male tone to it. The review has a male tone. Whatever about that in the gender business. That's a whole other thing. But this person, whoever it is, B flat jazz bass, shoot me an email, Ryan@thebassshed.com. I have some questions. And I won't interrupt you. I won't interrupt you. All right. Hit me up.
Excellent, sir.
What I wanted to do is you were talking about getting them, the students and the attendees, into the base camp, what they're going to run into occupationally. We started the conversation talking about that, how to have a diverse, you know, kind of income stream so that you're you don't exhaust your playing or the art or the creativity. How do you speak to young students about that? About like not necessarily to develop a secondary skill to, and that doesn't mean that it's, you're not making a living as a bass player or a musician, but how do you address that? Because at that age, I know I was, and maybe you were too. If you could just make your living playing the bass and being a musician, cool. That's it. That's the dream, right? To do the thing full time. And it always, I'm not sure what it's like now, for kids that age or young adults. I don't know if they feel like it's not, if you're not being successful, if you have something else you do for an occupation. But how do you address that? Because I do think even, you know, the heavyweights that you mentioned earlier with Christian McBride and Rufus Reed, going, you know, to anybody, you know, they have good teaching gigs or they do artist in residency somewhere, and they're, you know, they're not just making money off of doing records and touring.
Absolutely. I mean,
so how do you address that to the students and still kind of let them know it's okay to get into something else?
Absolutely. I mean, there's a difference, and you know, I have nothing against somebody who, you know, drives a truck for UPS, but there are ways to still have an association to what you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. You know, when, you know, I always tell people there's few jobs on the planet that, if you do well, everybody stands up and applauds.
Right.
That if you're doing anesthesia, you know, which is what my wife does, no one, it's like, they don't stand up at all.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
But in a sense, at a certain point, if there's a, you know, a show going on that we might have put together, I mean, we just did duets with the poet Nikki Giovanni and Christian. And mm-hmm. When people applaud, I thought about that, and it's like, yeah, I was part of that. And that applause still, I feel it in my heart. And mm-hmm. I think you find out where you fit within this world. And this world is not just that person on the stage figuring out what amp they're going to use, what transducer they're going to use, and all that kind of thing. It's where do you fit within that world. And that still probably includes a place of playing, and you know, which you might be most passionate about. But you may find even more passion in putting mm-hmm. amazing artists together, or mm-hmm. in helping with PR, or in any of those things that gives the tools artists need to do their job, which is really so affiliated with being a bass player. You know, mm-hmm. how do you, as a producer, how do you kick a soloist in the rear end when, you know, when they're getting boring and playing three, you know, choruses too many? You know, that's really what a producer does.
Yeah.
Making sure when they show up, they have the tools that make them comfortable. Making sure, mm-hmm. you know, how do you get the best cut, whether it's in the studio, whether it's, you know, on the stage. And a lot mm-hmm. of that was what I learned when I was with Max.
What kind of things did you learn directly from Max, or did what little nuggets of did he impart?
Well, I mean, I think Max stories. Max was incredibly passionate. He was very creative, and he also in his head knew how to run a band. We were preparing for a tour once. It was Max, Tony Williams, and Ginger Baker with his percussion ensemble and boom. And we were going to the Verona Opera Stadium. And Tony came in and they delivered the wrong set of drums. Because he had gone from Gretsch to DW, or DW to Gretsch. It was still those yellow drums that he always
did.
He goes, I'm not going to rehearse. I refuse. You know, these are the wrong drums. These are not my drums, and I'm not going to play. Max goes over to his drum set and starts playing a little bit. He goes, these are nice drums.
So it's Tony, just to recap, Tony was the one who wasn't playing?
Tony was the one who wasn't playing. He goes,
okay.
And Max goes over and he goes, these are nice drums. You know, is that okay? I mean, how about I play these drums and you go play my drums? And mm-hmm. Tony goes over, you know, goes, do you think I'm being an a-hole right now? He goes, yeah, just a little bit. He goes, you ready to play? He goes, yeah, I'm ready to play. So there's a bit of sanity that can come from someone who normally would be the person who's like, you know, oh my God, the video is wrong. Max was somebody who always had We're in the
process. You knew how to defuse the situation, it sounds like.
Oh, absolutely. You know, yeah. And he also could light the fire when he wanted to light the fire. Mm-hmm. And it's knowing the difference and when to do it.
Right.
He was very astute at that. He was also just a real visionary that, you know, there was, you know, you're on the top of your game each time. And know that the gig is going to be different each time. I spoke to a good friend of mine who was on the road with Herbie Hancock. Mm-hmm. He said every night they play in a different tempo. They play in a different key. So if you're not on it, but it's such a musical adventure. Max was kind of like that too. You know, it's like, okay. Oh, I added video tonight. Oh, you know, where there's a videographist who's doing the improvisational video behind it. You know,
okay.
We're working right now. He did a piece in early 60s called The Freedom Now Suite with Abby mm-hmm. Lincoln and Babatunde Olatunji and other people. And I had worked with him in the early 90s. To redo it. He did it with Abby Lincoln, and Abby couldn't do it, but ended up doing it with Cassandra Wilson and all those folks. And Ozzie Davis was the narrator doing poetry because he wanted to add poetry. Every time it changed a little bit. So we're redoing it now in January at NJ PAC. And we have Cassandra coming back. We have Sonia Sanchez and Saul Williams. Ravi Coltrane, Eric Rivas is playing bass. Now she waits.
Great.
You know, those, but in a sense, again, you look at it differently. You look at social justice now. You look at, mm-hmm. you know, all those types of things. And that's what Max would have wanted. Because, you know, it's the minute you start putting jazz in a box and it becomes dusty like museum music, why bother? And those musicians who kind of, you know, you want to preserve, you know, quality, excellence, all that type of thing, but you want to continue walking down the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, it's not Bach. People who play Bach,
right.
Like, you got to play it this particular way. And I understand that.
Unfortunately, I think when anytime jazz is institutionalized, it is conveyed in a Bach sense more than it is in a way that can be still culturally relevant. Because it's just like, okay, whatever, institution X, right? Yep. However they're going to teach it, they're going to go back to the same records, they're going to tell you that, and they're going to start with, this is what jazz is, and here are the records. And so on a young, impressionable mind, it's like, well, okay, I have to sound like that to do this thing. Instead of teaching the ethos of the music, of improvisation, and personal freedom, and having a personal voice within it, we're using the tenets of music and harmony and rhythm and time signature. We learn everything that creates the music, and now we do our own thing with it mm-hmm. in a way that's culturally relevant. I feel like when I came up, there was no talk about cultural relevance. It was only, here's what you do. Here's how you get through this set of changes. You learn these licks. You do this thing. And it becomes Bach. And it's awful. It's awful because that's not what the music is. And I think so often the institution runs it into the ground. Leading a bass camp, how do you approach keeping it relevant to, you know, the now culture with what's happening within the music business and within music to the students who want to pursue creative music?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you need the tools. You need to be able to play through changes. You need to have a level of technique. You need to have all those various things. But even back then, I mean, Max and I spent a fair amount of time with both Max and Miles, and they wouldn't use, as they called it, the J word. You know, there's just, mm-hmm. what is it, the old, you know, there's only two types of music, you know, good music and that other shit. You know?
Yeah, right.
It's because in their they thought it was racial. You know, if you read through Quincy Troup's biography, it's kind of like jazz is 5% of the market, and it was just a way to not pay black musicians. You know, that was where the head was. So, I mean, there's an opportunity in whether you're producing or whether you're doing a bass camp to, take a look at a career like Christian McBride. Here's a guy who grew up with Black Thought, Questlove, and and all those various folks.
Yeah, it was a young prodigy virtuoso. Like, he was doing those super bass records when he was 19 or 20 or something with Clayton and Brown.
Yep, but at the same time, you're not putting yourself in a. I mean, I just did a program with him, with his regular group, with Rakim, and Mos Def. You know, there's. It's not, you know, there are times when you put on that formal jacket,
you know, right.
We did some duets a little bit ago with Ron Carter and Pat Metheny, and I
saw
Pat, and he was wearing a jacket, and I'm like, Pat, I've never seen you in a jacket in my whole life. He's like, and he's like, I'm playing with Ron, and you respect, respect the bandstand, respect the music. It's just like, okay.
Yeah,
that doesn't
hilarious.
Mean it didn't bring him out of his head to do what he does, but some, you know, there's times when you put your feet on either side of the river, but if you're not looking at that other side of the river, that's when you get dusty. And I think having people, you know, whether it's a Questlove, whether it's you know, whoever it might be, to come out and talk about it as well. These are people who've found their way and can play the jazz side of the world. They can play the pop. They can play the funk part of the world. You know, you can speak to Christian probably twice as long about James Brown than you can. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe James Brown and, you know, there's a couple of bass players that, you know, could be equal in terms of him talking about stuff, but it's being well-rounded in terms of not just your fingers, but your ears is mission critical. Particularly if you're trying to make a living,
right?
You know, the smaller box you put yourself into, the smaller apartment you will be living in.
Man, that's a fascinating idea. And I've talked to a good drummer friend about this, and the drummer has done everything from like kind of legacy acts with old rock and roll. He's currently on the road with an old rock and roll guy from the 50s, 60s legacy act, but he's also done like cutting edge fusion stuff with Scott Henderson, you know, and just everything in between, 80s rock, blah, blah, blah. And him and I used to talk about it. He's like, man, you do one thing, then you don't get the calls, you know, because you only do the one thing. But then if you do multiple things, you don't get the call because you don't do the one thing. It's a double-edged sword, really, is either if someone is going to put all their eggs in one basket, do it and just do the one basket, and you better be really great at it, you know. Or if you don't, you have to realize that, like, well, the person who put their eggs in the one basket is going to get called over you.
Yep.
It's this kind of double-edged sword. I did not put all my eggs in one basket. I hope to have a diverse palette of musical experience to, you know, be a crossover guy. So I'm not, I feel like I'm never jazzy enough, you know, for the jazz Nazis, and I'm never this enough for that and whatever. But,
well, congratulations.
Yeah, I think so. I feel like it's more musical rewarding, and I like the variety more in what my performance week might look like. But not everybody does that. You know, I think there's value to both. I will say that.
I mean,
you know, and that comes down to the individual.
I mean, we're not all Christian McBrides, but I remember Christian first when he was a teenager, you know, playing with Betty Carter. And then I had like lost track of him until doing a show with Carly Simon. And Carly, because she had heard him, said, I want him as my musical director. And it was the first
time
she had played in like 10 years. And we did it at the Apollo. And he was.
I didn't actually know that about his career. I didn't know he played with Carly Simon.
Oh yeah. No, it's. And that's the thing. Like we, he did something at the Hollywood Bowl, last August, you know, 3 months ago. I don't know when this airs, but
I remember that because I was I worked with the store that was supplying him with the bass for that, I think.
He did this was a particular thing that he did as a tribute to Frank Sinatra and Peggy Lee. And we're redoing it here in February. And it had lots of side musicians and, you know, people, you know, Aloe Black you know, lots of folk, and you know, jazz folks, Broadway folks, all that type of thing. And out of the blue, I think it was him or somebody, you know, was at the gym, ended up at a machine next to Billie Eilish's mom, and ended up being on the gig, and because she loves Peggy Lee, and she ended up singing with his big band. And now
Billie Eilish was on the gig.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then out of the blue, I got a call from him yesterday, and I can say this now because I think it's going to air after Saturday.
Yeah, this will be out in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. You know, he got a call, and suddenly, you know, tomorrow night he's going to be playing a trio with Billie Eilish and Phineas on Saturday night.
That's sick.
You know, and play bass in her band. But I mean, there's no one as scary good as Christian, and the better spokesperson for the music, and no one would ever doubt his legitimacy from a straight ahead part of the world on electric or on acoustic. Mm-hmm. But by the same token, the ability to float between there to, you know, you call his phone number, and it's, you know, it's a message of James Brown announcing that he was part of the band. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. James Brown. I'm sorry, Mr. Christian McBride. I did a lot of dates with James, and it was, you know, he liked to pull people out too that same way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think at a certain level of talent, you can float.
Yeah.
And
I mean I like that. I personally like that, and the people who have had to use that term, you know, who have done those things and have floated between genres and styles and stuff, those have been the people that have been my inspiration.
Mm-hmm.
On electric and on upright, the people that are multifaceted in a lot of ways, because I get burnt out doing too much of the same thing. Maybe it's ADD, I'm not sure. When does the Milton Hinton, what's registration for it, and when does it begin? And talk a little bit about what the structure is going to be like for the program.
I'll tell you, I'm probably going to have to give that to you so you can put it, you know, on a, because I don't want to get it wrong. I don't have the nuts and bolts.
I do have the press release here. I do have the press release that the camp will run through July 14th through July 20th. Registration is open December 16th through June 7th. So, yeah, so actually today is December 15th. Registration can be, by the time this comes out, you'll be able to register any young bass player.
Go to the website. You know, the issue is we want to make accommodation for, you know, anyone who wants to come. So there's financial aid, there's all kinds of things. You know, the issue is, you know, we really like to create we really like to create a program where people aren't turned away because of their inability to pay. We really.
Yeah, I agree. That's something I feel very strongly about. Agreed. Yeah. Who are some of the other faculty members? So you have, Ben Williams. I'm looking at it right now. You do have Rufus. You have Ben Williams. I'm going to probably screw up some of these names. I apologize. Luis Perdomo?
Perdomo.
I'm you know, some gringo in there, but I'm that's it. Jeremy Smith, Sam Scruggs, Martin Wind, Marcus McLaurin.
McLaurin.
And yeah. Go ahead.
And that's just a beginning. Like, you know, again, speaking of Christian, once he finds out what his summer tour schedule is gonna be, if he's here, he's gonna be there.
You know,
there's a lot of players like that. There's a lot of, I mean, adding in people like David Gage and those types of folks, not just on the music side, but on the, you know, the pedagogical side, the, you know, that type of thing. You know, it's you know, that's the good thing about moving it from Wisconsin to New York. There is just a propensity of amazing bass players. And
is it because Milt Hinton's family or estate rooted in Wisconsin? Is that why that was for a little while?
Dominguez, who is the leader of this camp, originally had it in, I think it was Indiana or something like that. And
okay.
It traveled with him. And the thought was that it belonged in the New York area.
Yeah.
He's also the cool thing about Milt is just, you know, his work as a historian in terms of the music. I mean, his book, all of his photographs and videos
yeah.
and all that. He never showed up for a gig without a camera.
Right.
And he said, you know, it's what did he say? He goes, it's never the, you know, I don't always have the best photos, but no one else has the camera angles that I can take photos from.
Yeah. Now Milt Hinton is, I mean, you know, obviously regarded as, and rightly so, a jazz legend, but that is very much in a specific version of playing jazz. Does the camp talk about how to diversify music, and does the camp teach electric bass also? Does the camp talk about popular music and those styles?
Teaches electric bass. It goes beyond just the straight ahead jazz. Absolutely.
Okay. Okay. Because I mean, you understand, like you read, like, well, the Milton Hinton bass camp, you're like, okay. You know, like mentally you put it right in a place. But that's good to hear.
There's a starting point and a focus on upright bass players. They're mm-hmm. you know, I would be lying if I didn't say that's the beginning point. But but by the same token, as we're saying, to keep a career going, there's a lot of different ways, you know, directions a bass player has to move. And mm-hmm. a lot of that is doubling. A lot of that is, you know,
yeah,
you can be playing in a pit orchestra, can be doing a lot of different things.
I was going to ask about that. Are there classes or workshops about arco playing or arco technique?
Absolutely.
It covers the whole thing. So classical, jazz, from electric.
Absolutely. The thought is to give people tools to take their next step.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Cool. What kind of how many years has this been going in total?
This is going to be the first time in Newark, in New Jersey.
In New York, Newark.
But it's been going on for over a decade in different places,
okay.
Relations, whatever. The thing is to take
that's it
to
what
the
I was
next,
curious about.
The
yeah.
next step. I mean, NJPAC is a different kind of place in that we have mm-hmm. one of the largest arts education programs in the country. We spend about $6 million a year on arts education as a not-for-profit. So this allows us to link into a lot of those educational, avenues that are open to us. There's been discussions of teacher training. There's been, you know, now that we're in a world of virtual, how do we share some of these programs, these master classes, all of that type of thing? It's a different world. I remember before COVID, no one wanted anything taped, even if it was free. And even if it was now they're like, oh, we can share it with other people, you know, whether it's paid or whether it's just building brand. All of those types of people bring people to say, gosh, I'm interested in that bass player. I might be interested in their band. I might be interested in taking a class. I might be interested in whatever it is. So we find more and more with all the different people who we work with here at NJPAC that there's an excitement to share, you know, those types of things. We just had an event where Christian played with Savion Glover, the tap dancer. Mm-hmm. And we did it as a trio with him kind of playing drums as a tap dancer with a pianist. And it was just having discussions about creativity with dance versus creativity, you know, as a bass player.
Savion, I have to interject quick. Savion, one of my favorite artistic moments that I was able to witness was with Savion. And the story, the premise of it was a little unfortunate. One of my dear friends, who is a ridiculous saxophone player that actually did a recording with Christian at one point, passed away due to unfortunate circumstances. And his brother had taught Savion at one point tap dance. So when and my friend was Zane Musa, and his older brother was Chance Musa. Chance had taught Savion. And so when my friend Zane passed, we also wanted to honor Chance at the memorial. We got in touch with Savion. Savion came out. I have never understood. The dance has never impacted me to that level, because Savion would be just talking, just like this, while talking at the memorial service. And then he would stop and finish the statement with his feet. Mm-hmm. And it never lost the narrative. It never lost the narrative. You know exactly where he was going, and he finished the idea, and it still landed. And then he would start a new idea almost with his feet and then finish it verbally. It was so powerful watching Savion dance.
And it's really similar to what we were talking about with jazz. I mean, Excellence Travels. I worked with him at the Apollo when Greg Hines passed away. We did his funeral. Mm-hmm. And he did a similar thing. We did a kind of a dance-off from that White Knights thing that Gregory did. We put him on video, and they traded they traded eights, they traded fours, they traded twos, they, you know, all that type of thing. And at the end of the day, Savion has a great connection to the history of dance, whether it be Nicholas Brothers or Jimmy Slide or all those people from way back when. And at the end of any, they used to it at the Apollo for a long time, every Friday night. Now they just do it when someone, a famous tap dancer, passes away. They would do something called drawing the circle, where they would draw a circle about 3 feet wide, and everybody puts a dollar in a hat. And whoever can stay in that circle without repeating a step for the longest period of time is declared the greatest tap dancer in Harlem and hence the greatest tap dancer in the world. Okay. And it's like jazz players, because Sandman Sims does it. Everyone has, you know, everyone has those riffs they rely on. Everybody of has course. Vocabulary, and tap dance is no different. Mm-hmm. And they hold this caucus underneath the stage all the time when those things happen. At the same time, you know, Savion is the first to come and, you know, for instance, we have something coming up with George Clinton in Parliament Funkadelic, who's also from Newark, Parliament Funkadelic when he was in fifth grade. And he's going to perform with George Clinton. Because the idea for him, it's no different than performing with Christian or performing with Jimmy Slide, performing with George Clinton, because it is a musical dialogue.
Right.
Can have based on, you know, big ears and, you know, the talented chops.
Yeah. And just a direct connection to expression. I'm going to have to email you this clip. You referenced Gregory Hines, and the clip I have with Savion, Gregory Hines, and my friend Zane is when Gregory Hines came out with the movie Tap. Mm-hmm. And he was doing kind of this national contest, American Idol-ish, you know, kind of thing, like going around to different countries, having all these tap dancers come out and do the thing. And if you won the competition, you tapped on Donahue, you know, you won. And so my friend Zane won it. And I have the clip of Zane tapping on Donahue, and Savion must be like, I don't know, 15, 16. If you still know or talk to Savion recently, you know, regularly, I'm sure he'd be able to tell you his version of the backstory. But Savion's just staring at Zane like, damn, he's bad. It's a really cool connect from them back in when they were young. I mean, Zane was probably, I don't know, 12 or 14. Savion was around the same age.
And he still remembers what it was like to be that young person with the older hoofers and being led by the hand. And he still does that. I mean, he spends 5-6 weeks here a year. You know, for next to no money, just helping young tap dancers, where we'll just take people from the community and create a program with vocalists, bass players, drummers, dancers, whatever, and just create a program out of it. Because it's a matter of giving back. You know, we stand on the shoulders of the people who preceded us, and he remembers Jimmy Slide, and he remembers Gregory and Maurice when they were. Hines and Dad, you know, and the same thing with Maurice and Savion. We were sitting there talking, and he goes, the Apollo used to do 5 to 7 shows a day, and it was like 50 cents to get in. And once you're in, you didn't have to leave. So you could start like up in the balcony, and you'd stay through like 5 shows until you were watching the Nicholas Brothers in the third row.
Yeah.
You know, there was a coolness to that, you know, and Quincy played a trumpet on those things as well. So it's all this stuff just intersects. You know, the people, the talent, and at the end of the day, the relationships that you build as a bass player, as a musician of any type, you know, excellence radiates. And absolutely. it finds each other. And everything else is just an excuse.
That's right, man. I know you have to go. You have a show that you're getting to later tonight. I know you have a heart out. Man, please come back on the podcast and talk. I feel like there's a lot more.
Would love to.
There's a lot more avenues we can go down.
It's funny when you went to the Bass Institute. I do a fair amount, not as many podcasts, but in a sense, I was like, I thought I was here to talk about Max Roach. It's like, oh, I'm here to talk about the Bass Institute. Like, I would have had one minute in front of me. Sure. No, and all of them, all of it is related. All of it is this, you know, all is one, as they say. But I thank you for taking the time to talk about it and spreading the word. And you know, it's a cool thing. It makes a difference, and you spreading the word makes a difference as well. So thank you so very much.
All right. That was my talk with David Rodriguez. If you are enjoying the show, maybe more than B-flat jazz bass is or was or will be. I don't know about any of that. leave a comment and hit subscribe wherever you are listening to the show. If you would like to be featured on the Bass Shed podcast, please stop by thebassshed.com and click on featured. For everyone interested in the Milt Hinton Institute for Studio Bass, again, the application deadlines are June 7th, and stop by njpac.org/Hinton to get more information and apply. That's about all I got for this one, folks. That's all I got for this one. To continue the rant a little bit, I'm really not going to give a bunch of attention to negative posts. I don't know if it's negative. To people just, you know, whatever. Let's put it this way. Across the board, I'm probably not going to talk about any more reviews or comments. This guy just caught me on a specific day and time. And, yeah. So, you know, if he's out there, B-flat jazz bass, if you're listening, shoot me an email. I do want to hear from this guy. I want to connect. I want to connect with this person. All right, folks. That's all I got for this one. I'll catch you on the next one in a minute.